You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Victor Thorne, who's just written another book called Conspirality. Victor, thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's great to be here, Dave.
Victor, what number is this now? Do you know?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I have 40-some books published, so I don't know. I don't know the specific number.
That's amazing to me. You know, I've thought over the course of my life about writing books on various topics, and it's exactly what I've done, thought about them. And by the time I'm done thinking about it, you're done putting out another book. So that's really impressive. You're very prolific. And this, of course, is along the line of many of your other books in the conspiracy genre. I guess you're probably the most prolific conspiracy writer in the world, I would guess.
Other than Tex Mars, I would call him the most prolific with his newsletters and books and radio shows and DVDs. Yeah, I would put him as more prolific than me.
But just books, though, do you think you are?
I don't know. I'd say I'm up there for sure.
Let me ask you, let me start with this. Why Conspirality? What inspired you to write this book?
Well, there were a lot of subjects that I still hadn't covered. And what I really wanted to do is write about, in all of these various books, every single major conspiracy that there's been. And starting with New World Order Exposed, which came out in, I think, 2002. Up until now, there were still a few subjects that I'd been wanting to write about for years, but never got around to. So this one here is more like a smorgasbord, I guess. It's divided up into various categories, but it's a lot of the things that I've been following for years that I haven't had a chance yet to write about, and great topics in there. So it was my way of saying, well, these are all the ones that I haven't done yet, and I want to pull them all together and put them under one cover.
Right. I think I remember you telling me about that about 2 years ago. Is that right?
Yeah, that's really what I've been doing with all of these books is if you end up taking all of them and lining them up on a shelf, and if you arranged them chronologically, you'd have, in essence, an alternative version of history as compared to the official version of history. So, you know, there's not many left. I mean, there's still a few topics that I'm going to tackle, but this was to fill in some of the blanks along the way.
Okay, yeah, and it happens to be selling very well. So let's just go through the table of contents real quick. Of course, there's the introduction, Conspirality, and synchroconspiranicity. Did I say that right?
Synchroconspiranicity. So what I did was I took two different words, especially the title, conspirality. It means conspiracies are real. And despite a large segment of the populace not wanting to accept this fact, and it is a fact, that conspiracies are real. And the synchroconspiranicity part means that I delve into then synchronicities. And this is a concept really coined maybe close to 100 years ago by Carl Jung. And synchronicities are strings of unrelated events that are tied together and keep happening in succession way beyond the typical laws of probability, and everybody experiences them. You know, those aha moments when you're like, oh, that's so weird. You know, you're talking to one person, then later in the day, you turn on the TV or you read that, and it's the same exact thing. So it's a synchronicity. But it seems like, to me anyway, that the deeper you get in the conspiracy world, the more these synchronicities occur. And the introduction of the book was really an encapsulation of all the things that happened while I was writing the book and different people I was talking to, and everything weaved together. And it was a lot like New World Order Assassins, where there was a theme or a thread that kept running through all of the various chapters, and it carried over to this book too. So that's how I open it. And, you know, the more people pay attention to these kind of things or accept that they happen, the more they realize is that all of these things are happening, and, you know, it's up to us to be able to connect the dots.
Right. Actually, I just had a version of that synchroconspiranicity. Did I say it right?
Uh-huh.
I was going through some paperwork and came across a name that I hadn't paid much attention to for probably at least a couple of years. And strangely enough, the guy called me the next day. It was kind of weird. And some other things that I think this is along the same vein, when you're thinking about somebody that you hadn't thought about for a long time without going through any papers or computers, when you're thinking about them and they contact you out of the blue, is that something along the lines?
It's weird that you mention that because the book I'm working on right now that I'll finish up this week delves a lot into quantum theory. And once you start studying this stuff, you realize how it actually happens. So we know that it does happen. Once you start studying quantum theory, they provide the mechanics or the nuts and bolts of how this happens. And it really gets down to non-locality and communications going faster than the speed of light. And, you know, it's much deeper than we have the time to get into now. But in essence is, you know, you sent out some type of intentionality when you were thinking about this person. And for whatever reason, that's what the trigger event was. And then the next day they contact you. So, you know, I'm a firm believer in all of this kind of stuff. It all comes down to accepting it. If people won't accept that it occurs, then you open up the window and it, you know, you have an entirely different world.
I really believe that there's something to that because it's happened too many times, at least in my life, and I'm sure it's happened to other people. So the odds of that happening at the exact same time are just too low.
Yeah, and that's the key phrase is it goes beyond the laws of probability. That, you know, it's not, some people say, oh, it's a coincidence. But it transcends coincidence because the probability of all of these things happening over and over again like that, you just can't get down to the law of averages. So.
Right, exactly. Now, the book has six parts. Part one is New World Order Conspiracies, and there's six parts to that part one. Part two is The Curse of the Kennedys, three parts to that. Part three, True Crime Conspiracies, three parts to that. Part four, Societal Control, three parts to that. Part five, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, and there's two parts to that. And part six, High Strangeness, and there are six parts to that, and then interviewees, and then about the author. I read the entire book, but I concentrated on a few of them. And before I talk about that, are there some of them that in each part that were your favorite?
Well, the opening, the first one, is about Barack Obama. And being that I have a hatred for him that transcends, I think, anyone I've ever met, that there's all of these different conspiracies about him. And in my view, most of them legitimate. But this chapter here, without going into the details, even in conspiracy world, when you go way down the rabbit hole, this is so non-covered or so little covered and so important that that's why I started the book off with that chapter. And you know, I can assure anybody out there, when they read this chapter, they're going to be scratching their head and saying, is there anything at all about this guy that we know for certain?
Right.
Anything. I mean, his entire life is so shrouded in lies, deception, mystery, sending people off on wild goose chases. This chapter, I mean, I wrote an entire book called Frontman, which covers all the crimes and corruption and all of the different mysteries, like, you know, the identity of his actual father, Frank Marshall Davis. But this takes it to another level. And you know, all I have to say to everybody out there listening is, you know, read this first chapter, and it's a mind blower.
Yeah, I thought it was too. And again, though, it gets back to, and we've talked about this many times, even though all this evidence can be presented to the readers, to the public, it seems like they're unfazed by it. Would you agree with that?
I think with Obama, anyway, that we know so little about him and so little that's true about him that we've been overwhelmed by it. You know, he really hit the national stage in 2004 when he gave the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention. So really, the public has known this guy for less than a decade. And he really didn't burst onto the scene full force until 2007 when he threw his hat into the ring for the presidential election. So we've known him for maybe 6 years. And when you get all of the different things that don't add up, at a certain point, people just check out. They're like, what is real about him? Now, of course, most of the public, you know, believes the mainstream media and what they peddle. So if you talk about the birth certificate or whatever, then it's, you know, it's like, oh, okay, you know, the mainstream media says that he's legit. So, okay, we'll accept that. When in the pages of American Free Press, you know, Pete Papaheracles interviewed Sheriff Joe Arpaio's cold case posse. And it's absolutely, positively, 100% certain that the birth certificate he presented is a forgery.
Right.
It's an absolute, positively, 100% fact. Now, how this wants to be excused is beyond me, because if it's a forgery, and this is the best that the White House can present, is an absolute forgery with 9 different layers, if people can accept that, then so be it. But I can't. I don't believe that he's a legitimate president right now, at least constitutionally. So anyways, this first chapter goes beyond even this information. It goes into really uncharted territory and exciting stuff, if you ask me.
Yeah, it definitely is. I think we're living in a parallel universe. Part one, New World Order Conspiracies, of course, the number one story in there. Not number one, but the first story in there is Obama's mama, really his mama. Then you've got Operation Gladio, 2.0, 9/11, the Norway Massacre. Number three, TWA Flight 800, a case of mistaken identity. Pat Tillman, the murder of a military poster boy. Five, the Lusitania attack, blueprint for 9/11 and other false flags. Six, LA riots, 1992, a personal account. I really enjoyed that. You were right there. That's amazing. Then part two, The Curse of the Kennedys. Seven, which is part one, the assassination of John F. Kennedy Jr. Now, I don't want to give away the cliffhanger at the end, but I didn't know this stuff. That's pretty amazing.
It is. This is really fascinating material because if you ask anybody, and this would be the son of President John Kennedy, how did he die? And people say, oh, it was a plane crash off the coast of Martha's Vineyard, and it sounded like pilot's error because everybody in the media said that he wasn't qualified or equipped to fly this type of aircraft, and it was his fault, and he screwed up, and it's a tragedy, but that's what you get when you're flying airplanes that you're not qualified to fly. And I guarantee everybody that the story, the real story, is so different than what they presented to us. And it, again, without giving too much away, it ties back to the Clinton body count. So this is good stuff.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. When they get towards the end, they'll see what we're talking about here. But you mentioned Clinton, and perhaps many of the listeners aren't aware. You've written, what, a trilogy on the Clintons, right?
Right, yeah, Hillary and Bill.
So in one of them, you detail the number of murders that they are affiliated with, and it's something like over 100?
Yeah, 120 or so, I believe, was included. Yeah, the three volumes, one is sex, the second is drugs, and the third is murder. And from all the different Clinton body count material that's come out over the last couple of decades, I culled it all together, and it totals about 120 right now. So it's big numbers.
And growing. Number 8, the other side of Chappaquiddick.
The Teddy Kennedy chapter, which comes after the John F. Kennedy Jr. chapter, this might be the chapter that most differs with conventional wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only is this story vitally important because it destroyed Teddy Kennedy's chances of ever entering the Oval Office, but this even more so when you ask people, well, what happened at Chappaquiddick? Oh, Teddy Kennedy drove his car and he was drunk and he drove it off the side of a bridge and it killed the chick that he was fooling around with or had intentions of fooling around with that night. Well, this chapter goes so far in contradiction to that official story that when I first learned about it years ago, it blew my mind. I couldn't believe that what we were told and what this alternate account presents is, it's like night and day. That's how different it is. So that, to me, might be one of the most fascinating chapters in the whole book because, you know, if you have two sides of a coin, that's how completely different these two stories are.
Right. And, of course, a lot of these stories have a lot to do with how the version is presented by the mainstream media.
Yeah, correct.
Like, and I'm just going backwards here, but like in part one, the Lusitania attack, the way that the mainstream media played it out with all the anti-German propaganda, because the vast majority of people were against getting involved in World War I. And if it wasn't for the mainstream media doing this propaganda, the United States might not have entered the war, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the really strong points of this book, too, is for the Lusitania chapter, I interviewed Deanna Spingola, who does a radio show on RBN and is also an author of a couple books. And I think I interviewed 16 or 18 people for this book for the various chapters. So not only is it historical information, but I'm going right to experts, you know, right to sources that know about this stuff and getting firsthand information from them. You know, you get both sides there where I dig through the annals and find the alternate story, but then also interview people who know, you know, more about this than I do for sure, and they give me their expert accounts. So it's a nice balance or combination.
Yeah, absolutely. Part 3, True Crime Conspiracies. 10, Patty Hearst, the SLA and Death to the Fascist Insect. 11, Zodiac Killer, Into the Occult Underground. 12, Adam Goreitly Interview, Charles Manson and Beyond. What was your favorite in that part?
Well, all three of them really merged together because they all happened in California, which was a hotbed back in the 70s, late 60s and early 70s for this kind of information. And, you know, today we have Casey Anthony, and we have this Jodi Arias case now, the chick that stabbed her boyfriend. But back in the early 70s, at one point, Patty Hearst was the biggest news story in America. She was on the cover of every magazine, every newspaper. The nightly news covered her every single night. And she was, of course, the daughter of the newspaper heiress, the famous Hearst family. And one night, she got kidnapped. And it was a real tragedy, and there was all this outrage across America until a few weeks, or I guess more than a few weeks later, though, this footage of Patty Hearst breaking into a bank with a machine gun, and they hold up the bank, and she starts sending in these messages that are directed against her family. So, you know, you have this Stockholm syndrome where she's flipped, but if you see the picture, she seems like she's genuinely into leading this gangster criminal lifestyle. And, you know, I was only 10, 12 years old at the time, but I was fascinated with the story. And it went on for, I guess, almost 2 years, where she was on the run, and there was these big shootouts in L.A. and more bank robberies, and just an amazing, amazing story. And actually, the first ever live broadcast on national television of a shootout was during the Patty Hearst thing. So this was all caught live on the fly as it was happening, and you know, just transfixed the nation back in those days.
Yeah, I remember that too. I was about the same age also. Part 4, Societal Control, number 13, Edward Bernays, and of course, as you explained, that I guess Sigmund Freud's brother-in-law or something like that, right?
Nephew.
Edward Bernays, Enlightened Despotism, 14, The Frankfurt School, Cultural Marxism, and 15, Experiments in the Abuse of Authority. Why is this Part 4 almost vital to the entire book?
Oh, it's so vital. In January of this year, I published a chapbook called Dirty Harry for President. And I said in this book that after the 2012 election, where we had this atrocious candidate in Barack Obama, and we had another atrocious candidate in Mitt Romney, and a weak candidate in Mitt Romney. And, you know, in all honesty, if you look at the last 4 years, whoever the GOP put up should have trounced Obama, because he's been a horrible president, economically, foreign policy, and also socially. Well, this book examines, this Dirty Harry book, and also the chapter in Conspirality looks at the Frankfurt School. And this was a little known institution back in the 1920s. It was founded in Germany. And in essence, to give you the nutshell version, what they said is, we can't push hardcore Marxism in America. We can't go through the front door because the American people don't want Marxism. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the back door and corrupt them subtly, almost like a subliminal persuasion. And so what they did for the last 90 years is they've pushed this social agenda on America. And it's abortion, gay rights, feminism, multiculturalism, and on and on and on. And what I do in this book, and also the Dirty Harry for President book, is trace this Frankfurt School back to its origin, and then show how over the decades, like up into the 1960s with the hippies and everything and the New Left, how they slowly but surely just keep pushing this. And ultimately, Barack Obama is the poster boy for cultural Marxism. If patriots understand cultural Marxism and what an insidious, corrosive cancer it is on our country, I can't understand how one of them would ever, for even a millisecond, support Barack Obama, because he's the epitome. He's what they've been waiting for the last 90 years. He's the champion of cultural Marxism and the decay of American society. And it's a vitally important chapter because it exposes how, instead of hammering us with Marxism over the head, what they've done is just crept through the back door like a burglar and introduce it that way. And now with Obama, it's the culmination of everything they've ever wanted. He's a hideous example of what America has become. He's the enemy.
Okay, and the individual characters who are in the vanguard of this movement, what do they have in common?
Oh, many of them, many, many, many of them are Jewish. That's a certainty. You know, going all the way back to the feminist movement of the late 50s and especially into the 60s, as you know, you got Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem and, you know, Andrea Dworkin, all of them, they're all Jews and Jewesses. I want to someday write a book totally devoted to feminism. You know, one thing that most people don't understand is that the seed money for feminism came from the CIA. And also, there's this famous quote from David Rockefeller years ago where, you know, he was looking at 1950s traditional America where the father went out and worked and the mother stayed at home. And David Rockefeller said, half of the people aren't paying taxes. We have to change that. So what they did was introduce feminism and, you know, like, women can have everything. Why should you be forced to stay home under your husband's thumb and do nothing but cooking and cleaning? You want to go out there and get a job, don't you? And women are like, yeah, we want to get jobs. Now, 40 years later, women are exhausted. They're disgusted. They're divorced and they're tired. And they're like, we don't have it all. We don't have it all by a long shot. And so the whole thing has been a scam job. And, you know, most of these people that started this movement are Jewish.
When you say most of these people, I'm curious. I'm very interested in this because, again, it gets back to the odds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jews are a very small percentage of not just the United States population, but the global population. But just looking at the United States population, they're about 2% of the population. And out of those 2%, there's a very small percentage who are the movers and shakers. So when you say a lot of these people were Jews that are in this cultural Marxism movement or phenomenon, when you say a lot, what percentage?
I couldn't come up with a percentage, but it transcends, again, the law of probabilities, that if they were only associated with this in accordance with their percentage of the population, that would mean that only one or two of them would have been among the cultural Marxists. When we see that all of the major players, all of them, and, you know, that's what this chapter in the Dirty Harry book is about, is that, you know, I name the names, and it can't be an accident. It can't be a coincidence that all of these people are Jewish. And again, it can't be an accident or a coincidence that their poster boy is Barack Obama. When he was rising up through Chicago, all of his main bankers were Jews and Zionists. And, you know, even in his elections, he had many Zionist backers. And Mitt Romney wasn't the only one that had Zionist backers. Barack Obama did, too. So people that fluff this off and ignore it aren't looking at the actualities, because it's no coincidence that Barack Obama is the poster boy for cultural Marxism. This isn't an accident.
Okay, part 5, the Federal Reserve Conspiracy, number 16, Richard Nixon, Watergate and the Fed Connection, and 17, Interview with G. Edward Griffin. That Richard Nixon part, to me anyway, was pretty amazing, because I remember, just like you do, we were like, what, 12 years old, 13 uh-huh. years old when all this happened, and we remember what a big deal it was. These two magnificent reporters were able to bring down a president. When I was in college, we read All the President's Men, and it was just amazing that these two guys, on their own, with a pen and a pad, went and took down the president. But that's really not the way it happened, right?
No, it's not at all. And this is a fascinating chapter, because akin to other presidents in the past who have met untimely ends, there always seems to be a connection to one institution, the Federal Reserve, or the creation of money. In another book that I put out last month, it's called Conspiracy Hollywood Style. It's about different Hollywood movies that have conspiracy themes to them. I devoted a whole section to All the President's Men, the book that you mentioned. And you're right, David, we're all brought up. Here we are in the media, the news business, and Woodward and Bernstein, you know, we're supposed to look up to them as that's the epitome of what good, hard journalism, hard-nosed journalism is. But when you start seeing what else was involved with Nixon, and I'm not a fan of Nixon. I'm not trying to portray Nixon as a hero, because he was a creep, he was a thief, he was a mass murderer, and what he did in Vietnam was beyond the pale. So I'm not trying to elevate Richard Nixon up to some artificial level that he doesn't deserve, because he was a creepy Rockefeller boy.
Scum.
But, yeah, he was scum, exactly. But in this chapter, it shows from an insider that worked in the Nixon administration that he had ideas, I'll just say, to go contrary to the Federal Reserve, and people have to read the rest of it. I can't remember any time ever in the mainstream media where they've broached this part of the story. So this is good stuff.
Part 6, High Strangeness, 18, Stanley Kubrick, Eyes Wide Shut and the Moon Hoax, 19, The Abduction of Travis Walton, 20, MK Stargate, 21, Analysis, Project Soul Catcher, 22, An Alchemist Speaks, Escaping the Reality Hoax, and 23, Chemtrail Genocide. I enjoyed the Chemtrail Genocide chapter because even though there's some extreme ideas in there, you could see something like that really happening. Would you agree with that?
I do. And I interviewed one of the maybe greatest unknown figures in the conspiracy patriot movement. His name is Vinny Sammartino. And I've known him. I've protested with him up at Ground Zero for the 4th anniversary of 9/11. And this guy comes up with things that nobody else finds. And I don't know how Vinny does it. I don't know where he gets it. But he exerts a lot of influence over a lot of different people that do radio shows. And he's not a kind of guy that comes right out into the front. He's not a limelight kind of guy. He works behind the scenes. He's always paying attention. And a lot of times when a news story breaks, I'll pick up the phone and call Vinny just to make sure I'm on the right path, because he always has a different perspective and a different way of looking at things. Yeah, the chemtrail chapter is wild, and what he comes up with. And the thing that's most interesting is that it's possible. it's possible what he comes up with, chemtrail genocide. You know, I saved that one, so maybe I could say the best for last. But the whole final section, High Strangeness, gets into a lot of things that the typical patriot community, per se, doesn't like to delve into. So the chapter on Travis Walton, you know, I spoke with Joan d'Arc, who used to be the publisher of Paranoia magazine and is still the editor and contributor. You know, this is a famous case back in the 70s where Travis Walton disappeared for 5 or 6 days. And I heard an interview with him years later where he still didn't know what happened to him. He knows that he was gone, but when asked, well, could this have been some kind of government operation? He said, it could have been anything. All I know is that for 5 or 6 days, I was gone. I was disappeared. And then I was dumped back alongside the side of a road. So, you know, even though people say, oh, UFOs, that stuff's too weird. That's too spooky. That's really what I cut my teeth on back in February of 1990 when I started investigating all this stuff was UFOs. And then led to the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderbergs and all of these other things. So, you know, I still have a great interest in it. And I try to sneak some of it in whenever I can.
It's good stuff. You know, I just want to step back a second to the chemtrails. There's obviously a lot of controversy about that, and you can read about experts and pilots who say one thing or another. But what I think about when I see the chemtrails is when we were growing up in the United States, as early as, let's say, 10 years ago, did we ever see those kind of trails in the air? And if not, why are they there now? Is anybody saying anything about that?
Well, that's hitting the nail right on the head, Dave. And I see them now because I walk my dog 3 hours a day. We're out every single day. And I look up and I see them. And then, you know, if I'm walking through a parking lot or whatever, they're crisscrossing each other. Sometimes they make designs up there. The whole sky is filled with chemtrails. And then I look at everybody else. And you know what they're doing, Dave, as they're walking? They're looking down, staring at their cell phone.
Surprise.
Nobody is looking up at the sky. Nobody's looking up there. So I'll say, look up there. And they're like, oh, yeah, wait, hang on. I got a message coming out of my cell phone here. It's the perfect plot to get everybody as they're outside to look down. And if you go to any city in America, go down the street, drive down the street, look at the people. Nobody's looking up. Everybody's looking down at their cell phones. We didn't have these chemtrails back in the 70s or 80s when we were growing up. This is a recent phenomenon, and shouldn't people ask, what are those things doing up there? You know, of course, the debunkers will say, oh, that's just a contrail. That's just condensation. Well, if they believe that, then they can go back to living in Santa Claus land if they want to, because they've been proven not to be condensation trails.
Right, and that's what I was saying. Are there any photographs of planes in the sky making those trails prior to when they became prominent? Let's say we're looking at photographs from the 1960s, 70s, 80s of planes in the air, and there's plenty of them. I don't remember any of those photographs having these big trails behind them, do you?
No, they didn't exist. Because what differentiates a contrail, condensation trail, from a chemtrail is that the condensation trails dissipate after a few minutes at most. And that's what you would expect, that condensation evaporates into the air. But these chemtrails last an hour, 2 hours, and if the whole sky is blanketed with them, what they do is they all just merge into each other and create a blanket that envelops the whole sky. I was outside all the time when I was a kid playing baseball and football and everything like that. So, you know, if they were up there, we would have seen them. They weren't up there.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Exactly. You hit it right on the head. We were outside, right? We weren't inside as kids. We were always outside. I've never seen that like it is now. Has anybody come forward to offer an explanation as to why it's prominent now and it didn't exist when we were growing up?
Well, there's all kind of different theories in alternative media. If you'd ask me if I could honestly say there's one of them that I buy into as the definitive explanation, I wouldn't be able to. And certainly not in the mainstream media.
That's what I was alluding to.
The mainstream, absolutely not. They don't even touch the subject.
Right, but I mean, couldn't they come forward and say, you know what, a lot of people are concerned about these trails in the sky that obviously did not exist 10 years ago and they're prominent now. Here's the reason why there's the trails. That's never happened?
Not to my knowledge have I ever. Yeah, but we used to, back in the Wing TV days, protest up in front of the newspaper. And for a week straight, every day we stood out in front of the newspaper holding signs, pointing up to the sky, and we were protesting because we had written an op-ed column about chemtrails. And they said, no, no, we're not publishing this. Absolutely not. And finally, after 7 or 8 days of this, doing it every single day in a row, they finally relinquished this, the local newspaper, and they published this op-ed piece. So it might have been the first ever, you know, the first ever mainstream newspaper article on chemtrails that they published.
All it takes is just for these imbeciles, instead of, like you said, looking down at their phones and wasting their time on their phones, just look up and think. Think 10 years back. That didn't exist. It exists now. There's something. See, they can't even do that. People are not even capable of putting those thoughts together. That's why it's hopeless.
And sadly, kids nowadays aren't like we were back in the 70s out playing all the time. They're in front of their computers playing video games and doing social media. So even nowadays, kids, if you talk to them about it, they're like, I don't even know what the hell you're talking about. They're not outside playing baseball for, 5 hours a day.
Exactly. And they don't look up. Victor Thorne, the author of over 40 books and chapbooks. Again, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to the listeners, and looking forward to speaking to you again when your next book comes up.
Well, I appreciate being on, and I urge everyone to get this book, and I guarantee that once they start flipping through the pages, they'll see stuff they've never seen before. And if we're all doing this for a reason, that's it, is to expand our horizons and get beyond the smokescreen of the mainstream media.
Thanks, Victor.
Thank you.